My name is Winston Nichols, and I am the president of the board of directors of the Garvey Institute. Sounds a little bigger than it really is. I don't often get the chance to say I'm president of anything. But I'm very happy to see you here. I know you have given up your Sunday afternoon, and we're very pleased, in fact, to welcome you on behalf of the Garvey Institute. I'd like to start by thanking McGill University for making available this space to us today, but not only giving us the opportunity to meet in this august institution, but the university itself has been very enthusiastic in supporting the effort that we are carrying out as our little contribution to the celebration of Black History Month. Obviously, a lot of you know that McGill has a special interest in it because the speaker, Dr. Frederick Berkeley, the youngest of the Berkeley clan, is a graduate two times over of McGill University, both at the undergraduate and the graduate level. He was so good that we couldn't keep him in Canada, so he's gone off to the the U.S. And as you might know, if you read the article in the Community Contact recently, you'll get a summary of the things he's done in his career. Secondly, I'd like to thank, obviously, the Franklin Institute of Philadelphia, U.S., where Dr. B. works as the executive vice president of the organization. Now, this is a nonprofit organization which is almost 200 years old, right? And it has always concentrated on bringing to the city of Philadelphia outstanding scientists, technical people, inventors, but making clear to the people of the U.S. and beyond the U.S., in fact, the importance of science and technology in the economic development of countries, and also trying to integrate the innovations of these people in the school system to make it part of the educational system of the country. So we are very happy to have the opportunity to see from one who works right in the middle of the activities of the Franklin Institute an example of some of the things that this august institution does. And I want to stress too much, because we have heard over and over again the importance of role models for young people, and I think both the examples that Dr. B is going to present to us and he himself illustrate the existence of numerous role models that are appropriate for our young people to hear about, and their achievements are something for the young to aspire towards. So we look forward to hearing some of the exploits of these people. I was listening to a news item recently, the person presenting was alluding to the fact that the U.S. keeps slipping when we measure the achievement of students in the system, keeps slipping in math and sciences and so on. I think perhaps the same sort of statement might be made of Canada. That it is so critical for a country to keep abreast of what is happening, and to especially in its application to the educational system. So I think we want to keep this in mind as we watch the examples that he brings to us. And I hope that some of the youngsters here, as well as their parents, will be influenced to think seriously of careers in the various sciences and mathematics and so on, because otherwise we're going to continue to be left behind as an ethnic group. So, without any further ado, I'm going to call on Dr. Frederick Bertley to carry us on this ride, and we are very happy to have you here.
Nichols, what can I say? Thank you very much for such a wonderful introduction. It's interesting. He took me way back to the days of Vanier, one of my most favorite professors, and being in a room where you're speaking to a crowd again, I really appreciated that. It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you all for sharing your Sunday, spend some time with me. As an active person involved in the Garvey Institute, it was very important for us to think about creative ways to continue some of the great work of the Garvey Institute, and so we partnered with the Franklin Institute, and with, of course, McGill to put this on. So thank you all for coming. This is where I work, Franklin Institute. We're going to talk a little bit about the color of science. And as was mentioned, I really want to thank McGill and the Garvey for putting this on. But before I start, I'm going to do something that I never do. I never dedicate a talk ever. It's not necessarily appropriate. But here, it really is appropriate for so many reasons. So this is dedicated to my parents, my mom and dad. For lots of reasons. Here's a shot of my dad. When he met Mandela, when Mandela was released, he did a world tour, including coming to Montreal, and the Afro-Canadian was critical in supporting and trying to get him released by writing articles that did get received all the way in South Africa to say, look, you got to let this guy out of jail. This is ridiculous. And so when he came here, the original Dr. B and the official Dr. B, my father presented him with actually a bound copy of the original articles that helped to get him released. Also, the other thing my father always taught me about was character. You have to have character. No matter what you're doing, try to have that integrity. Also, my mom, who is here with us, remember this picture? She's a force in her own right. This is her here. This is not by any stretch to demean saying that this woman is in the kitchen, but to make the point that as a great West Indian parent, she made the best fried bakes on the planet. And that's what she's stirring up there. But the other symbolism here is both of them actually went to this great institution. My dad, this is actually his graduation picture. He's just around 20 from Trinidad. Here he is graduating from McGill. And this is my mom getting her master's degree from this institution. And this is a really funny picture, just to show you how dedicated my dad is to McGill. If you look real close at the chest, it's actually the McGill crest. And this is about 60 years ago, where it wasn't actually sewn on, but it was actually wired with metal. And we still have that blazer to this day. And ultimately, because this is Black History Month, before science, before religion, before everything, it's, I shouldn't say before religion, but before science and before education, it's really all about family. And this is our family. From my brother in the top left, Albert, to myself, Fred, my mom, my other brother, John, my sister, Deb, and of course, my dad. So this is dedicated to my family. So now, let's begin. So I love putting this slide up, especially in the U.S., because I get two kinds of reactions. White folks in the audience are like, oh man, we let this revolutionary guy with the black power fist. And the black folks in the audience in the U.S. are shifting because they're like, oh, he's an uppity Negro. We didn't know. We shouldn't. Very interesting response. But I'm not talking about that kind of revolution. I'm not even talking about the redcoats are coming or the redcoats are coming or Che Guevara. I'm talking about a different kind of change that we are currently undergoing right now in the world. What am I talking about? I'm talking about a revolution in science. Right? I mean, this is where science used to be not so long ago. Today, it looks like this, completely transforming every bit of our society. You cannot wake up and get throughout the day without being impacted in a serious way by some aspects of our science. So much so that we don't even talk about science anymore on its own. We talk about STEM. Many of you heard this term. It stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. I'm going to give you some examples to kind of prove the point here. So if you think of nanotechnology, that's the technology of the very, very small. What you're looking at here looks like a regular, ordinary vial of some liquid. But actually, It contains these nanoparticles that are tiny particles you cannot see with the eye, but that are charged or coated with specific anti-tumor capacity. And so they can inject these particles in you, and they can navigate through your blood system, target the tumor, and start to specifically destroy the tumor. Right? What about down here? It looks like a casual windshield. It's actually not. The windshield is covered with nanoparticle biopolymers, and so much so that any kind of precipitation that hits the windshield disappears in an instant, whether it's raining, snow, or slush, so obviating the need for windshield wipers. We're not going to have wipers on cars soon enough. And this is my favorite. This looks like regular paint from Home Depot or the Common Warehouse. It's actually not. The paint has been laced with luminescent nanoparticles that when you roll this on your ceiling or on the wall and you put a very, very small electric charge through it, it will glow, changing lighting forever as we know it. I mean, how cool is that? And it's way more environmentally friendly, green, and much cheaper. So that's nanotechnology. Is there evidence of science being important in our lives elsewhere? Well, let's look at engineering. So, okay, we can talk about a nice, fast engineering car. Right now, some of my colleagues over at MIT are working on a different kind of car. This car can actually hold two grown adults. But the cool part about it is the car can actually be compartmentalized, so much so that they can be stacked as grocery carts. 100% electric. They cannot, of course, they're not made for the highway yet, but they're going to revolutionize city traffic. You don't own the car. You park it. You pick it up when you need it, just like your grocery cart. You drive to where you go, and you park it back at the next station. Unbelievable. And this is happening right now, folks. Of course, aeronautics, we all know there's all kinds of technology there. Everybody in the room, I'm sure, has a cell phone. We can't even conceive of our lives without this technology. But this is all science, technology, engineering, and math, despite how cute the covering may look, or you might put a leopard print or something. It doesn't matter. It's really technology. This is interesting. This gentleman is Dean Kamen. He's the world's current leading inventor. He has 440 patents. You might know him from the Segway. So if you've ever seen that machine with the two wheels that wheels around, he's the person who invented that. He invented a wheelchair that can go upstairs for handicapped folks. He's done tremendous inventions. Well, what you're seeing here are not some bad boy Jamaican speakers for a blockout party. Those black boxes that you're seeing are actually called the Slingshot, and they actually make purified drinking water from any liquid source. Now imagine, you're in a developing world. The number one issue is clean water, not just for nutrition, but for health and disease transmission, etc. And here this man invented something that no matter what the water, the liquid source is, you can get purified drinking water. Unbelievable. The sad part about it is our world's a little interesting. He couldn't get any governmental organization to take him up, even though he's this most famous inventor. No one wanted to underwrite the capacity to go from making it in his lab to go to scale to solve a lot of the problems in the developing world. Finally, guess which company picked up? Coca-Cola. So we can talk about that in a minute. It's going to have a red swoosh on it. But anyway. And this, of course, anybody know what this is? It's an artificial heart. So imagine today that if you have a bad heart, they can actually crack open your chest, put this in, and get another 20 years out of you. I mean, this is really unbelievable. Now, we can talk about the ethics and all that around should you have an artificial heart, and what does the heart mean to your spirit, and all that kind of stuff. And I leave that for the ethicists. But it's just a remarkable technology. Of course, in energy, there's all kinds of technological changes. We all know about solar panels. You don't see them everywhere yet because they're not as efficient as they should be. If you load up energy in them, they're about 30% efficient. But 6 months ago, a Japanese group has radically changed that. Now they're looking at about 70 to 80% efficiency. So soon, we're going to have low fuel bills because we'll be able to have solar power panels everywhere. How about communication? I talked a little bit about the cell phone. Anybody use Facebook or Twitter in this room? I'm sure the back or all the kids are like, yes, do your parents know your Facebook site? I'm just kidding. So, you know, absolutely, communication is critical. But how about these two people? Well, why is the gentleman at the bottom smiling? That's Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and CEO of Facebook. Well, of course he's smiling. His company had the largest IPO, public offering. He's worth now $50 billion, billion with a B. I mean, we can't even conceive of that number. So much so that he is considered to be the richest young person since the pharaohs in ancient Egypt. I mean, that's just unbelievable. So you remember a little boy, you know, King Tut? He was the richest person. Now it's Mark Zuckerberg. The top two people are Larry Brin and Sergey Page. They're actually the founders of Google. Well, why do I have it versus Facebook versus Google? Because what you don't know is these people are actually competing for your information. Yeah, it's fun to put up your picture, and yeah, it's fun to surf the web on Google, but you ever wonder why when you turn on Google, all of a sudden you get an ad for something you're interested in? Like, did you ever think about how did they know right? That, oh, I like shoes, or oh, I wanted to go to Barbados, or how did they figure that out? Because you have search patterns and search history. Well, Google and Facebook, they figured that out. And information is power. So they're jockeying, battling back and forth. Google's stealing Facebook employees. Google employees are going over to Facebook. It's really going on right now. But what's amazing, and what we don't hear, is these three people, who are some of the richest people in the world, are rich because of science, technology, engineering, and math. Everything that makes Facebook work and Google work are mathematics, algorithms, and computer science. Just like your cell phones. That's all technology from the hard science side. Global warming, there's tons of information here around science. I'm going to talk a little bit about my field, genomics. I'm a life scientist. And, you know, we all eat fruit. We all get fruits and vegetables from your grocery store. Anybody grow them in their own backyard? No one? Okay, maybe a little bit over the summer, but for the most part, you buy your stuff. Well, almost everything you buy has been genetically modified. Almost every, and those of you who go to Whole Foods or Trader Joe's or these healthy food stores, that just means that they didn't use pesticides. It does not mean that the genes that actually grew the stuff haven't been genetically modified. Very interesting. Is it important? Yeah, we should know about it, right? Right now, we're not sure how that's going to impact humanity, but it may be a problem 50 years from now. We might find out that, you know, we shouldn't have eaten that. Same thing for the beef and poultry industry. These have all been modified at the genetic level. I put this picture up because we've all gone through this. You bought a tomato. You put it on your counter, come back 1 week, it looks just like it looked when you bought it. 2 weeks, looks just like it looked. 3, 4, 5 weeks, it still looks plump, red, juicy. Well, that's not natural. We have engineered DNA inside the tomato to extend its shelf life. Why? Because you got to grow it in somewhere in South America and ship it, and you don't want it to spoil because you want to maximize your profits. But do we know that? Do we pay attention to that? Well, we should. And I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not passing judgment. I'm just saying we need to know about this and think about this. This last panel is called an Affymetrix gene chip. You've all heard the Oprah story and a bunch of other folks who are doing the cheek swab or plucking the hair to try to chase their genetic lineage back to where they came from. I don't know if some of you follow that. Well, this is how they do this. And the other thing they do with this is sequence the human genome. One of the greatest things we've been able to do in 2000 was to map out the entire genome of the humans, and we'll talk about that in a minute. I put this picture up because this is Monsanto. Anybody heard of Monsanto? Fair enough. Well, we should all know about Monsanto because they own greater than 92% of all of the patents that go into genetically modified stuff. Now, is that of interest that one company controls all that? Sure it is. But again, I leave that for you all to think about. Personalized medicine. This is interesting. Personalized medicine, now that we can sequence the human genome, has the capacity to say, okay, you might be susceptible to this, or you might be at risk of that, based on understanding your DNA and your genotype. So, for example, here's an individual who was given Vioxx for arthritis. Turns out, a few months later, he has a massive heart attack and dies. They didn't know what happened. Well, now we know what happened. It turns out that he had a genetic signature that his body would not react well with that drug. Well, now we know that. So if you're going to prescribe Vioxx to somebody, the doctors can just take a little prick of blood or your hair follicle, do a quick DNA screen and say, we better not give you Vioxx, that's dangerous. Here's a drug that'll help you. Similarly here, this is a gentleman from Miami. He had a heart attack. They gave him Plavix, which is a standard drug. 3 months later, he had a really, really bad heart attack. Well, it turns out now we know by sequencing the human genome that 25% of us in this room cannot have that drug. It'll kill us or make us really, really sick. All right, what about this? Anybody know what that stuff is at the top? Bacteria, good. And, of course, on the bottom are some beautiful pictures of our human family. Well, the other piece that sequencing the human genome taught us was how close we actually are to bacteria. It turns out at the genetic level, every one of you in this room is 95% identical to bacteria. Now, I don't know about you, but when I heard that, I didn't feel so good, right? I mean, that's incredible. How about monkeys or apes, etc.? Well, it turns out we are 99% identical at the genetic level, identical to apes and monkeys. And the best part is all of us in this room, all of us on the planet, are 99.9% identical. So what does that tell you? That tells you, first of all, that racism is absolutely stupid. So in the celebration of Black History Month, we should think about this, that it's crazy for someone to judge somebody based on their race when we're 99% or 99.9% equal. I mean, those of you who've gone through school and done tests, imagine you got 99% on a test. How would you feel? Pretty damn good, right? All right, fair enough. And so the other really cool thing is that 0.1% difference is actually what explains the beautiful diversity in the human family. And the last piece I want to talk about around genomics, I touched on it earlier, is this allowed us to put the final nail in the coffin to understand where humanity came from. So we all knew from archaeology evidence, anthropological evidence, that, okay, we thought the first humans came out of Africa. Well, now through scientific testing, through analyzing DNA, it's definitive, it's clear. Humanity grew up in northern Africa around the Ethiopian region and then spread out throughout the rest of the world. And this last picture I put up to make the point that this is not Photoshopped and these aren't blue contact lenses. This is an African girl from Sierra Leone. Her parents are quote-unquote black Africans, and these are her biological eyes. So when you talk about the diversity coming from Africa, etc., here's definitive proof in the 21st century. All right, so I hope I've convinced you that science is important, that the STEM revolution is real. Well, how do you get STEM evolution? How do you think of new creative scientific things? Well, innovation is actually the driver behind that. So, for example, you can imagine way back in the day, they're trying to come up with a wheel. This wasn't working out so well, chipped away at it. And finally, by being innovative, they came out with the wheel. So what I've done is I've gone back in time to pick some supposed scholars to see, you know, have people been talking about innovation for a long time? So here's Francis Bacon, and he says, as the births of living creatures at first are ill-shapen, so are all innovations, which are the births of time. So it talks about if you want to innovate, it's going to be different, a little awkward, a little ill-shapen. Here we have Barbara Jordan, one of the first African-American female senators. She says, we are a party of innovation. We are willing to suffer the discomfort of change in order to achieve a better future. So now we're talking about if you want to innovate, you got to be a little uncomfortable. You're going to push the envelope a bit. You might upset some people, but you got to think outside the box. James West, we'll talk more about him later. He says innovation enables humanity to jump from merely being alive to actually prospering. Here we have Margaret Wheatley. This is interesting. She says innovation is fostered by information gathered from new connections. Innovation arises from ongoing circles of exchange. Knowledge is generated anew from connections that weren't there before. So it talks about you can't work in silos anymore. You can't be by yourself in-house. You have to work with people. You have to make connections. And by making connections, new things will come from that. Dean Kamen, I talked about him. He's a gentleman who came up with the segue. He says innovation is one of those things that society will look at and says it will change the way we live and work. Bill Gates used to be the richest person in the world. Now he's the second richest person in the world. He says, never before in history has innovation offered promise of so much to so many in such a short time. So first we saw innovation, okay, it's a little uncomfortable. Then you got to think outside the box. Then you got to partner with people. But most importantly, it can lead to massive changes real quick. And that's one of the things that we're seeing with technology. I mean, the cell phone's really 20 years old, the smart cell phones are about 5 years old. I mean, things are changing dramatically and very quickly. Tribute to Steve Jobs, one of the greatest innovators of all time. He says innovation distinguishes you from being a leader to a follower. And this works well in the United States when I talk, so I have to put a picture of Barack Obama. And he says, this is interesting, because he actually gave this as a speech to the nation. And he says, the first step in winning the future is to encourage American innovation. What we can do is spark the creativity and imagination of our people. We're the nation of Edison and the Wright brothers. Innovation doesn't just change our lives, it's how we make a living. So from the president on down, as you said, Mr. Nichols, they're worried about education in the K-12 system, even in the undergraduate system. He's saying that, look, we got to get back to this, because this is how we're going to change our lives. So, okay, so science is important. Innovation is how you get there. What about sustaining innovation? Do we have any important points that, okay, well, we need to sustain this? And I'm going to come and transition this to Black history. You'll see. All right. So let's look at some civilizations. So perhaps the first STEM civilization or first science, technology, engineering, mass civilization that the world has known is the Egyptians. I mean, if you ever have the chance to visit those pyramids, they are unbelievably scientific. And I like to point out that they were built on the continent of Africa. A lot of people, for some reason, think Egypt got on 747 and left the continent of Africa and is somewhere else. It's actually an African nation that's responsible for building that. But, you know, they're not as innovative today. How about Italy? I mean, Italy was once unbelievable in terms of being innovative. They lasted for centuries. They're now gone. Let's jump from that to corporations. Anybody use MySpace lately? Anybody know MySpace? I mean, the young folks in the back, some of them don't. MySpace was, you know, the equivalent of YouTube or what have you. It was the hottest technological thing. But they couldn't sustain the innovation. How about Netscape? Any unusual people in the room? Ah, we have a few fossils back there. All right. Appreciate that. Appreciate that. I hear you. Stick with what you know. Very important. In the U.S., I mean, the whole automotive industry almost completely disappeared overnight. But through the stimulus package from the president and the whole federal government, they resurrected the American automotive industry, and they worked really hard in the last few years to be innovative, so much so that GM now was the number one selling car company in the world, and Ford and Chrysler, for the first time in years, have made record profits. Anybody use Groupon? Anybody know Groupon? Okay, so Groupon is that kind of coupon thing. You get it online, etc. Well, Groupon, and here's the president and CEO of Groupon, Andrew Mason. Of course he's smiling because before Facebook, in November, Groupon had the largest IPO for any technological-based company. And he made like 10 or 12 billion. But he now looks like this because he's really concerned because his thing that made him very wealthy, it's hard to sustain. I mean, at the end of the day, people are going to get bored and say, you know what, I don't need that coupon. So he's scrambling to figure out how to stay innovative, how to do that. And so is Facebook and Google, but they have, especially Google, has a lot more meat behind it. Well, I put this picture up, not to boast at one time I did have hair, and not to showcase the fact that I still drool when I talk about science, but more importantly, that photo was taken with this camera. This is a Kodak Instamatic. Well, we all know Kodak. We all love Kodak. Matter of fact, if I go back, you all remember that flash? That square flash, poof, turns 90 degrees, poof, turns out. All right, remember that, right? Well, the problem with Kodak, even though we all know the film and we've used it, is they didn't believe in the digital photography world. So they slept on that, and guess what? 4 weeks ago, they declared bankruptcy, and after 130 years of dominating photography, Kodak is no more. Now, they're trying to get back into it, but the point is that they're gone. So, okay, so STEM plus innovation plus sustaining innovation really leads to our future. And as you mentioned, this is definitely true in the U.S. and it is true in Canada, that in the 70s, there weren't a ton of jobs around STEM, but now we're talking about 50% of the jobs are either going to be directly STEM-related or peripherally related to STEM. So we need to encourage our kids to get into that. It's very important. We talk about job market, sustainability. I mean, STEM can be an answer. So in terms of STEM education, it'll lead to employment, it can lead to economic empowerment, socioeconomic improvement, and ultimately make society a more harmonious place. All right, so what's the problem? Here's the problem. In the US, and this is also true in Canada, this is how the STEM table looks for kids in school. Kids aren't running and jumping and getting into science, technology, and math. There are no kids at the table. We need to change that. It needs to go from that to this. And you need to have all kids, white kids, black kids, and we need to pay particular attention to ensure that the black and brown populations get into this as well. We represent large percentages of the population in the U.S. and Canada, but if we're not STEM literate, we won't be part of that workforce and we'll be left behind. So that's at the K-12 level. How about in college? Well, it turns out if you look at the college distribution of people who apply, you know, in the U.S. and in Canada, about a third do social sciences, about a third do business or finance, and about a third do science and engineering. It's a nice normal distribution, you know, one-third, one-third, one-third. When you stratify that by race and you look at the African-American populations in Canada and the U.S., or the Native Indian populations, or the Hispanic populations, this is what you see. Completely skewed over to social sciences. Now, I'll be the first to tell you, social science is crucial. It's an important discipline. We need to know it, understand it, and it helps keep our society in a good swing. But we have a smaller percentage doing business and finance, and an even smaller percentage of African Americans, African Canadians, Native Americans taking this stuff on. We need to shift that back, and we need to make sure that we're having a lot of black and brown folks at the undergraduate level pursuing these disciplines. So how can we fix this? Well, I'm a huge fan of Green Lantern, so we can wait for Green Lantern. Or if many of you have seen Waiting for Superman, the movie about American education, we can wait for Superman to try to fix the problem. But I submit to you a more practical approach. One is to recognize two main things. One, basic math. Now, when I talk about basic math, I'm not talking about calculus. I'm not talking about y is equal to mx plus b or algebra or matrices. I'm talking about simple statistics and probability. We need to teach our kids that it is way more probable and likely that you can become a physicist, a chemist, a doctor, an engineer, a scientist of some kind than it is to be Denzel Washington or Paris Hilton. Right? All the images we're giving our kids, we need to say that, hey, if you want to be a singer or you want to be an actor or actress, that's a wonderful dream and I have nothing against that. But we need to teach our kids about probability and backup plans, etc. Right? I mean, how easy it to be LeBron James or, these folks. I know who she is. I wasn't struggling because I didn't know her name. all these people, we all know them. We all know them. I put up Jay-Z in particular because I'm a fan of Jay-Z. I love music, and I'm a fan of Jay-Z. But here's a person who completely transformed his whole life. He's now very, very wealthy. But he's been meeting with Warren Buffett, the third richest person in the United States, to think about how to solve the problem for education. So he's a person who came out from a struggling background, poor African-American, made his money because he's super talented, shifted into business, and he's not trying to get the next hot rapper. He's trying to figure out how we're going to solve education for Americans, all Americans. So we need to talk about statistics to say, look, let our kids know that you can chase your dreams, but you know what? You can become a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer with some hard work. The second thing, and you touched on this, Mr. Nichols, is role models. Do we have role models? Well, we're in Black History Month, and we all know in this room that every Black History Month, we hear the same guys. You know, there's Benjamin Banneker, a wonderful mathematician. This guy who came up with the almanac. We talk about Rebecca Cole. She was one of the first Black women to get a medical degree in the United States from Philadelphia. Talk about Garrett Morgan. He's the person who invented the traffic light and the gas mask. Of course, C.J. Walker. She's the first Black female millionaire. Lewis Latimer, the person behind the light bulb who worked with Thomas Edison. George Washington Carver, of course, we all know about the peanut, but he did so much more than just the peanut oil stuff. And you can't be at McGill and not talk about Charles Drew. For those of you who don't know, Charles Drew went to undergrad in Amherst, Massachusetts, but he came to medical school here at McGill. He did his MD degree, and then he did a master's in medical science. He's the person that made blood transfusion possible. He figured out a way to stabilize blood so it can be housed for a much longer term. And he graduated from this school, so I have to pay homage to him. What's tragic is how he died. Anybody know how he died? Exactly. He got into a car accident in southern United States, I think it was Georgia, and because he was Black, they would not give him a transfusion, which was based on the very technology that he invented for the world. How tragic is that? So these are all important stories, but let's keep it real, folks. How are you going to excite the next generation if we keep talking about these wonderful people from history but don't talk about any contemporary folks, right? So history, just like social sciences I mentioned, is absolutely vital, but are they more modern-day role models that we can look to? So this is where we get a little fun, some audience participation here. So guess who? Who's on the left? No one knows the person on the left? Oh, come on, I know half of you my age know who that is. All right, so that's Cuba Gooding Jr. on the left, of course, a famous actor. On the right, anybody know?
No.
Okay. So Cuba Gooding Jr. on the left. On the right is Dr. Mark Dean. Anybody use a personal computer? I think we all do. Well, he owns the 7 patents that made personal computers possible. African-American guy, PhD from Stanford. He's been a senior vice president at IBM for years. And the reason why all of us use computers, whether it's laptop, desktop, you name it, it's because of this guy. But we don't know that. We don't talk about it. Right? All right. How about this? Everybody knows Morgan Freeman, right? The voice of God. All right. Fair enough. How about the person on the right? This guy I showed before, absolutely. So on the right is Professor James West. He made cell phones possible. He and his German colleague, Gerhard Sessler, invented the little microphone and speaker that's in every one of our cell phones. And they had a lot of technology that made cell phones possible, but nobody could figure out how to do the vocal piece through the speakers. He came up with that. We don't hear about it. Of course, we all know Oprah on the left. Anybody know the person on the right? That's Dr. Betty Pace. She is actually right now about to cure sickle cell anemia through her molecular biology techniques. Unbelievable. I put this one up, and I feel a little sad when I show this. I feel a little sad when I show this because Tiger Woods clearly is not smiling like this anymore. This is an old picture, all right? But the person on the right is Dr. Arlie Petters. He's a Duke physicist who's working right now on Einsteinian relativity, and he's working on trying to debunk and change some of our understanding of Einstein's theories. Unbelievable. Of course, we know Angela Bassett on the left. This is Dr. Sharon Haney. She is a senior scientist working at Merck Pharmaceuticals. She's a biochemist, and she's done amazing things to impact all of our health. All right, I can go on. Billy D. Williams, Dr. Edward Tunstall. I'm going to come back to him, too. He's responsible for the Mars rover. Remember years ago when NASA sent a rover to Mars? Well, it was headed up by this guy and another person. Imagine that. The person who sent the Mars rover to Mars was African-American. Never heard of this, right? But we know the actors. Of course, we know Bill Cosby. I talked about sequencing the human genome. Charles Rotimi is one of the persons who's leading the NIH movement for the whole human genome process. Of course, David Chappelle, comedian par excellence. On the right is Dr. Chad Jenskins. He's at Brown University. He's got the largest grant supported by the Navy because he's a roboticist and electrical engineer. And he said, when I asked him, well, why did you get into that? How did you get so good at robotics? He said, I grew up playing video games. Imagine our kids knew that playing video games can get you here, right? We have all these kids working in our neighborhoods, playing with video games, taking it apart, figuring out how to do the coding to do the lethal kill on this and da-da-da. Well, that's all software programming, right? But we don't think that that can lead to a career in this field, and we got to teach that. Here we have Star Jones, and let me go back here for a second. I put this up to say it's not an age thing either. He's young. He's about 28 years old. Rising star at Brown University, the Ivy League institution in Rhode Island. Here's another rising star. This is Carmela Haynes, right? She is at Harvard Medical School. She's a molecular biologist. We don't have to go too far, though. This is here someone from McGill campus. Of course, you have Don Cheadle on the left. This is Dr. Momar Ndao, whose office is right there in the Round Medical Building on the Hill. He is a parasitologist, and he heads up several different national entities for McGill and for the country. So role models, yeah, we got them. But we got to show these people to our youth, right? So you might say, oh, okay, Frederick, fair enough. But you know what? They're black. That's why we don't know about them, right? So it's really a black community thing. Well, part two of the quiz. Anybody know who this person is on the left?
Oh, yeah.
Brad Pitt. Anybody know the person on the right?
No.
Okay, well, he's the colleague of the person I told you who was working with Edward Tunstall. These are the two people who co-headed the team to get the Mars rover on the planet Mars. Right? Anybody know the person on the right?
No.
On the right? Martha Stewart, of course. We all know Martha Stewart, but no one knows the person on the left, right? Well, the person on the left is Sandra Faber. She discovered black holes. Now, let me stop here for a minute. Imagine you go hang out with your friends, and, oh, you meet a star. They play for the Alouettes or the Canadiens, and you walk up to them and say, oh, you know, what do you do? I play for the Montreal Canadiens, or I'm the quarterback for the Alouettes. That's cool. Imagine they ask you, what do you do? And you said, I discovered black holes. I mean, that is unbelievably powerful and profound, right? We don't know about it. Here, of course, we all know the actor on the right. The person on the left is Dr. Paul Barron. He's responsible for the internet. Everyone in this room uses the internet all day, every day. It's because of this person, yet we don't celebrate that. All right, Jackie Chan. Good. Do you know the other gentleman? Anybody use a touchscreen on their iPhone or the bank machine? Well, that was invented by Jeff Hahn. He did this at 24 years old, dropped out of Columbia University and worked on this thing, and now almost every touchscreen that you use is created by this man. I know all the older folks are like, who? We have no idea who they are. The top left is Justin Bieber, the young sensation, heartthrob, etc. But we don't know the kid on the bottom right. I'm showing you this to say that it's not a race thing or an age thing. It's all people. Anybody play Angry Birds?
Yes.
Right? There you go. So Angry Birds was the number one downloaded app in 2010 until a 13-year-old kid named Robert Ney came up with Bubble Ball, and his app was the number one downloaded app, right? He's a kid. He had an interest. His parents supported him. They bought him a MacBook, and then he was off to the races. So my point here is while we need to educate all of our young, and this is a Black History Talk, so we're trying to support getting more black and brown kids into science, I want to frame this for you all to appreciate that this is a national problem in Canada, U.S. We don't know scientists, period, black or white. And, you know, further tested, if I asked you all to name three scientists, So if you are a scientist, obviously I'm not talking about you. For people who are not scientists, and I said, or don't know scientists, I said, name some scientists, you heard it. You're going to hear Albert Einstein, maybe Madame Curie, and I work at the Franklin Institute, so I have to say Benjamin Franklin, right? But it's hard for us to come up with that. And then if I push the envelope and I said, name three living scientists, you all be stuck. You might talk about that one guy, you know, I think he's in a wheelchair, he kind of speaks funny. Stephen Hawking, there you go, Stephen Hawking, absolutely, right? But we don't know these things, right? So the question is, why do we know more about singers, actors, athletes, and scientists than we do about people who are changing the very world we're in, right? So we all know her, right? Why do we know LeBron James, but we don't know Ben Carson, right? Okay, well, good for you. Good man. Tell the crowd who he is. Tell the crowd who he is. I know you got it. Good. So he is the leading neurosurgeon in the world. He works at Johns Hopkins University, and he's the person who did the first separation of identical twins stuck at the head. He's unbelievable. He's one of the best minds out there, but, you know, a lot of us don't know. So I said, you know what? I'm going to get to the bottom of this. So I'm going to ask the richest person in the world, at the time he was when I was talking to him, Bill, Mr. Gates, tell me, what's going on? How can we change this? How come we don't know, you know, the people that are changing our world, but we know entertainers? He's like, well, I don't know, there's this and that. Didn't have a good answer. So then I said, you know what, let me ask someone different. All you dog lovers, I apologize, I'm a dog lover too. This is Michael Vick, but this is after, of course, he was let out of jail. But I went to ask him, because I said, you know, Mike, here you are, a football star in college, football star in pro, and you made a horrible decision and blah, blah, blah. And you were scrutinized through the media forever, even though you went to jail, you did your time, people are still hounding you. What's your take on why people are just focused on you and other athletes and entertainers and not other things? And he was like, man, brother, I don't know, but it was real, real rough. What we don't know about him is at Virginia Tech, his best subjects were science. He now has a foundation in the United States that's supporting getting all kids, not just black kids, all kids into science. So even Michael Vick, a quarterback, understands that. But still, why aren't we paying it attention? Is it money? Is it because these rock stars are making a ton of money? Yeah, they make a lot of money, but I can assure you they don't make anywhere close to what these big scientists who have these huge discoveries make. If you think about Facebook and Google, that's all science. Yeah, we know them as entertainers, not so much entertainers, but as business persons, but it's science that made them the richest people in the world. Same thing with Bill Gates. Microsoft is all about computer science and coding and mathematics. So it's not money, it's this. It's the role of the media, folks. We need to talk to our media. I love entertainment, I love sports, I appreciate all that. I'm just saying we need to have some balance. If we're trying to change the scale and teach our kids different things, we need to get the media to be serious about shining a light on some of these wonderful other things that people are doing. All right? If you don't believe me, let's do a poll of what the three top stories are of the day. I'm in the U.S., so this is jaded U.S. specific. Right, and I got to tell you, being in the U.S. and watching the Republican race has been painful. Fortunately, the top right corner has fallen off the scene, which is good. For those of you who do not like Barack Obama, imagine it was that man Kane. So put it in perspective. But the point is, this is what we're preoccupied, right? Politics. If you're from the state of Pennsylvania, you know who this person is. For those of you who haven't followed the story, this is the very, very horrible individual who molested children at Penn State. This made national news. Why? Not because it's Penn State, an unbelievably strong academic university. Not even because he molested children. Why do I say that? Because people, unfortunately, do a lot of that, and you don't get that kind of press coverage. He got all this attention not because he abused kids, but because he was part of a sport team in college. Like, how warped is our media that that's where we're putting all our attention? Now, this one I say, the next one I say with absolute respect, because I'm a huge Whitney Houston fan, and her death is obviously untimely. I'm sure everybody in this room appreciates Whitney Houston. You know, again, you couldn't watch any channel yesterday without being absorbed in this. It's all over the news. So where does this leave us? Well, we got to balance the equation. And this is what some of the stuff that we do at the Franklin Institute, which I'm going to talk a little bit about. So as I showed you, this is a picture of where I work. It's the oldest science institution in the country, started in 1824 to do three main things: to recognize scientific discovery, to recognize the men and women behind that, and third, to educate the citizens about what they called mechanics and the arts. That's the 200-year-old term for science, technology, engineering, and math. It's actually the National Memorial. Most of the U.S. National Memorials are in Washington, D.C. So you have Lincoln, Jefferson, Washington. Matter of fact, they just unveiled Martin Luther King this year. You remember that? That's done in Washington, D.C. Well, the only National Memorial that's not there and that's actually inside is at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. So, and our mission, which is stated here, is to inspire a passion for learning about science and technology. All right. We do a lot of things. One of the things is we have state-of-the-art exhibits. We had King Tut come there in 2007. We had Body Worlds, Cleopatra, mummies. And we had a cool exhibit on race. This is interesting because this was not a black exhibit. This was an exhibit on all the races. It was formed by the National Science Foundation in conjunction with the American Anthropological Association. And they wanted to do a real scientific study on this whole thing we talk about race. And it was a fabulous exhibit. We had a Galileo exhibit. That telescope you're seeing was actually the last remaining telescope of Galileo. We had a Leonardo exhibit. We had the Science of CSI, that really cool show on television. Currently, we have dinosaurs. So these are some of our traveling exhibits, meaning they come, they stay for 3 months to 6 months, and then they leave. But we also have continuous exhibits. One of my favorites is the giant heart. We actually have this giant heart that you can walk through like you are a red blood cell, and it beats. You go from the atrium into the ventricle, into the other atrium, into the other ventricle, and you exit, and it's going boop, boop. But matter of fact, if you Google the two words, the heart, Franklin Institute comes up first. If you Google the term, the giant heart, Franklin Institute comes up first, which is kind of cool. That's not the American Cardiology Society or something that comes up first, but that is our institution. We have amazing machines, looks at mechanical engineering. We have a cool exhibit on changing Earth, really looking at how we've impacted the planet Earth and the whole greening, sustainable movement piece. You cannot be the Benjamin Franklin Institute without having an exhibit on electricity, so we have that as well. Aviation, Train Factory, Kids Fest, Sports Challenge. We have four theaters. We have IMAX Theater, Planetarium, something called Franklin Theater, and then our Demonstration Theater. But that, folks, is really just the tip of the iceberg. When we talk about informal science, we're talking about teaching people or getting people excited about science outside of the classroom. So whether it's through internet, through exhibits, through all kinds of stuff, that's what we do. So we have an awards program, for example. It's the oldest comprehensive science awards program in the world. It's 80 years older than the Nobel Prize. And we give prizes in physics, chemistry, life science, earth and environmental engineering, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering. And this shot I put in here, because this is the Franklin Institute, that's the memorial, the big statue of Ben. The light's a little too bright, so you can't really see it. This is the most hoity-toityest event in Philadelphia. It's $1,000 a ticket, black tie, red carpet. But the reason why I put this up is the most lavish event in the city of Philadelphia is actually around science. And that's really powerful that the city of Philadelphia got that and says, you know what, we need to put a lot of attention to folks there. Here is my boss, the president, and he's giving the two people I spoke about earlier, the African-American Jim West and his German partner, Gerhard Sessler, he's presenting them the medal in 2010 for their unbelievable accomplishment of figuring out the speakers, microphones, and specifically cell phones. Here's a shot of some of the folks who've won our medal. But we do a lot more than that. We have a Philadelphia Science Festival. This is where we go out to all the neighborhoods and bring science to the people. I mean, it's really amazing. We're in every neighborhood. You know, it doesn't matter the socioeconomic status. We are there working with kids, with grandparents, you name it, getting them excited about science. We have lots of programs that get girls and families into science. We have professional development. We work with all the teachers throughout the School District of Philadelphia and the greater Pennsylvania region to try to help them be stronger science teachers in the classroom. We do a lot of educational technology for all you kids in the room. If you go to the website, there's tons of stuff, games and exciting things you can play around science. This is near and dear to my heart. We have a really robust youth program. This is where we work with all kids, but especially black and brown or underserved kids, and we actually bring them into detailed scientific programs and experiences where they can really get to learn about stuff. So by the time they get to college, it's a no-brainer for them. They consider science. This is a traveling science show. We do 220 school visits every year across the United States of America. I put this up because you blow stuff up and kids love it, get their attention, and then you can talk to them about science. Here's our high school. We also oversee a high school. This is a graduation. But the other thing that's relevant to what we're talking about here today is we do a robust Color of Science program. okay, which is a three-part program. We have these 25-foot banners shown here that hang right near the statue of Benjamin Franklin that I showed you. And then we have a whole bunch of these 8x8 big boards that circulate throughout the museum that showcase different African Americans who've contributed significantly to science. We also have a collaboration with the National Academy of Sciences, which helped us create these banners, which are 8 foot tall, 2 feet wide banners that also are spread out through the museum. And it's amazing. We put them up. We started at Martin Luther King Day weekend, January 18th, but we don't just end it at Black History Month. We carry it throughout the year because it's important to show images all the time to kids that there are other options out there. Here are more examples, Creative Mind, Mathematics, etc. So that's the first piece of the Color of Science. That's actually an exhibit piece. The second piece is programming. We have an adult program and then a student program. So the adult or community program, we take four scientists who've transformed the world, African-American scientists, we bring them in a theater like this, we pack the house, and we have a Charlie Rose-type intimate one-on-one discussion with one of our persons, Derek Pitts. He's our chief astronomer. And then we bring them all up and have a panel discussion. Here are some shots from that kind of evening. And it's interesting. I mean, Philadelphia, and I don't know how many of y'all know this. I actually didn't know it till I went there or till I knew I was going there. I researched it. Philadelphia is 50% African-American. You know, a lot, I mean, if you think about New York or Boston, that might be 10, 15%, but Philadelphia is 50% African-American, yet there's virtually limited programming to serve that audience. So when we did this event and they came, they couldn't believe what they were learning, and they were so happy that Franklin Institute was doing this. These are more shots from the event. So that's the adult thing. The student program is a little different. Every time I give a talk, I try to bring a prop. So this is my prop. This is actually your passport to the Color of Science. And it literally is a passport, and I'll show you what the pictures look like. So what we do is we bring those four scientists that we brought the night before, and we bring another six for a total of 10, and we create this passport that has a map of our museum. We put these scientists in different areas in the science that's related to them. So the Mars guy, for example, he'll be in our Space Command exhibit. The computer guy will be in our electricity exhibit, etc. And we have bios on all these people. And then we take 300 students, break them up into groups of 15, and they spend the entire day going around the museum interacting with these scientists. And I got to tell you, it's the most exciting thing. Here's our Space Command guy. Here's Dr. Chad Womack. He's a life scientist as well. He's going over vaccines with these students. Here's one of our cardiologists. This is interesting, actually. His name is Dr. Albert Hicks, and he started at the Franklin Institute as a 13-year-old. And our tagline from him is from West Philly to the White House, because he came from West Philadelphia and is a snot-nosed kid, didn't know what he wanted to do, came to the Franklin Institute, participated in our youth programs, stayed all the way through middle school, all the way through high school, graduated from Howard University undergrad, Temple School of Medicine, and now he has a prestigious cardiology fellowship at Johns Hopkins University. And he will tell you that it's programs like this at the Franklin Institute and other institutions that are doing this kind of stuff that made the difference in his life. And the reason why we say from West Philly to the White House is in 2010, we had to send three people to the White House. We had to send our president and our chair of the Board of Trustees, and they needed a third person. I said, you know what? We need to send someone from our youth program. And so he went to the White House because we received this prestigious award. And so at the time it was the First Lady, actually, Michelle Obama, who presented a wonderful prize to the Franklin Institute, but really pointed out him and the programs that we're doing. So I'm making the point to say these things work. You expose kids to this stuff, they get it. And they get excited, and they see people that look like them in these roles, and they decide they can do it. Here's some more shots of the day. But the best part is this. I mean, look at these young ladies. Absolutely jazzed to spend the entire day in a science museum, right? The greatest moments, though, are right here. Ladies and gentlemen, these people are signing autographs. I mean, can you imagine? The students are so excited, and adults, for that matter. We're all requesting adults from these great men and women. So the result is what we all need to do as a society is change the DNA of science education. If we think about the metaphor of science education being DNA, where you know you have the students and the teachers as everything, it needs to change from that. We need to have the students and teacher be part of the backbone, but the glue, the stuff that binds, we need to open up beyond the schools. You need to have science centers like the Franklin Institute or the Science Museum in Montreal over there by the old port. You need to have technology centers. Higher eds like McGill and Concordia, et cetera, Vanier, John Abbott, you need to pay attention to that to do supporter programs. And you need industry partners, Merck, Wyeth, you name it. They need to be all part of this whole kind of revolution to try to get kids more excited about science. So school needs to go from this to this, where folks are really working together. And so ultimately, we can take the science school bus that right now looks like this. It's got one little lone white boy on it going to science school by himself. We need to change that. It needs to be packed with all kids, girls and boys, white kids and black kids. And if you look at the smiles, that's how they need to be in terms of thinking about science. And that way, they'll have the skill sets to ensure that our planet has a future and can prosper. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.
We want to thank you for breaking the color barrier here. Something to remember McGill by. Something to remember our museum by. I can't help it. He's been plugging the Franklin, and I'm glad we're connected, but you got to take these things back to the Franklin.
Absolutely.
And hang it on the wall to remember the color of Canada.
And I will take a photo.
Thanks, everybody.
I will take a photo. I'm happy to take any questions. Sure.
I really found your talk very inspiring. Two things you mentioned. Once you mentioned water to anything, you can take any kind of liquid and turn it. I was just thinking of your desert. You've got nothing to drink, but you know what?
You know what works. So let's get a little more graphic. Body fluids, so waste fluids, two kinds, number one and number two, as gross as it sounds, can get processed through this machine, and you will get pure drinking water out of it. Fair enough. Charcoal is a good first start. It's like your Brita filter. That's charcoal, and that's a good first start.
But I want to ask you about STEM. I heard STEM from the State of the Union address from Obama.
Yeah.
The only other time I heard it was from the president of China. Mm. He happens to be a chemical engineer, and he mentioned STEM as well. Mm. But when you go to listen to the politics of the United States, there's no STEM. So I asked an economist, what is the equivalent? There's nothing. There's what you call FES. The financial, economic, social, and political. That's our whole culture. There's not one mention of science in there.
I mean, that's a great point.
Republicans will never mention that ever.
Sure.
I mean, tell me how you vote maybe.
That's an excellent point. I mean, no question the leadership from Obama and his team, Arne Duncan, who's the head of the Education Department in the U.S., are talking about STEM, but it doesn't distill down. One of the reasons is the Republicans are interested in a bunch of other stuff. They talk about job creation. They haven't connected the dots that STEM will help in job creation, so they're not using those words as much, which is a shame. And that's why, you know, things like the press need to push this forward so people can realize that it's important and does impact everybody and everybody should be engaged. So that's a great point. Thank you. Sure.
Yes, I'm from Kenya. What I wanted to ask is about medicine, because there is a lot of herbs that are grown there, and we send people there to do some research,
sure.
But when they get the research positive, we are pushed aside.
We don't
exist anymore.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering, where can we go?
I mean, that's a huge point and a big problem. I mean, I don't know how much you all have been following this, but without question,
places like Africa, India, the Caribbean, there's all these herbal medicines and traditional medicines. You don't know why your great-grandmother rubbed soft candle on your head, but you know it got you better when you had a cold, or whatever it was. There's all these different things that we know work, and they're traditional medicines, but for-profit companies have figured this out. And as you're saying, they'll go to these places and they'll work with you and they'll take the herbs, et cetera, that you say might cure this and cure that, and they'll bring them back to the lab and they'll deconstruct them to figure out what the active ingredient is. But per your point, they most of the time don't engage the local folks or the local communities. And that's a big problem. Yeah, no, that's a big problem. And I mean, you know, to be frank, it starts from senior leadership. You know, the president and all the politicians and all those leaders that have the power need to put restrictions, or at least say, okay, you're going to come to my country to study our stuff. We need to have a piece of that intellectual property or a piece of that. We need to be part of it. And so you need better leadership is the unfortunate piece of that. But I feel your pain on that, absolutely. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
About stem cell and MS, the connection.
So the question was about stem cells and MS. So MS is multiple sclerosis, which is an autoimmune degenerative disease that impacts your spine. If you know anybody who has it, it's really a terrible, terrible disease. STEM cells is different from the STEM that I was talking about. So STEM, I was talking about is science, technology, and math. STEM cells is that cell in your body that can divide into almost every other kind of cell. And so there's this huge research on stem cell biology to say, okay, if we can start off with a stem cell and figure out how to tweak it, we might be able to set it up so that it can cause nerve cells to regenerate and, for example, inject that back into a MS patient and try to regenerate their nervous system. We're not there yet. We're close. There's a lot of wonderful discoveries that are happening along the way with STEM-based technology, but we're not 100% where we need to be yet. So, thanks. Yes?
Well, in reference to what my friend Frank was saying, the engineer, have you ever figured out how much, like, if the government's going to be obsessed about dollars and cents, can you not take it to them as dollars and cents? Because, I mean, you're wasting kids' lives. I mean, you're just going to... Kids born in school is just going to take off. And especially the gifted kids, they get born the quickest. They've got the greatest potential. They're the biggest voice. But can you not appeal to people's baser instincts and say, like, we've got so many... My brother's business is paralyzed right now. He cannot find qualified people. And it's to the point where he doesn't want to risk capital on something that might fail. Because at least if he does this, he knows he's got the market. But I mean, you know, he's nosy. He's an inventor. He'd love to try this, but he doesn't have the backup. It's to the point where my 79-year-old mother and my 81-year-old father are working in the plant with him because they're the only one are willing to try something new and see if it works out.
Well, that's a fabulous point. And I mean, if you're asking politicians to be logical, I can't help you there. Now, per your point about talking about the money, that's a huge enigma to most reasonable folks because you're absolutely right. The fact that we don't have enough trained Americans or Canadians means folks are coming from foreign to take those jobs or we're sending all our jobs offshore. That's problem number one. Problem number two, if kids aren't staying in school and they're dropping out, they may do more crime, they may do more this, more that, that eventually costs society money anyway. So you're absolutely right, but I mean, you know, you're asking the money question, which is how do you get politicians to wake up and understand that they will be saving the state or the province or the nation money by supporting a stronger, better, more rigorous scientific, and not just science, but the whole education system.
And here's this kid. If we do nothing, he's going to be asking if you want fries with that. Yeah. If you put him, you know, $50,000 and put a good science program in it, and you know, they're going to school, will save money because they're going to have an organic farming program, they're going to have a composting program, the kids are going to show up, so there's going to be less work running around truancy. Do a dollar value. Say, this kid is worth this much.
Yeah. No, I hear you. And I mean, the short answer is folks have done that. I mean, folks have done the math and showed the comparisons between, but, you know, at the end of the day, governments are going to do what they're going to do and they're going to push what they're going to push. We just have to keep trying to do what we think is best. So, yes?
Well, to add a personal comment, I'll come from the finance side. So I'm not going to your area at all. I have no prior experience in science, but from the finance standpoint, there's a risk to a reward and a return on investment, and unfortunately, the U.S. and Canada, and probably other parts of the world too, they don't want to put the money into the risk. They want the sure return, and that's obviously going to cripple the innovation. It's going to cripple the sustainability, because especially coming out of the recent economic problems that this country and the country to the south, and now Europeans also, they're not willing to take the risk, but it's a short-term view, because they're looking at the short-term sustainability versus the long-term sustainability. Unfortunately, the business leaders, which are tied to the politicians, especially the Republicans that are invested in big business, they're not going to take that risk. They're going to invest in the oil, and they're going to invest in the pharma, and they're going to invest in perhaps pharma to a recognized point, and not to, let's say, go and find those all-natural healing methods, because then that's going to compete against those drugs that are giving huge profit margins. And to your point with the education, I think that's one of the key ills, other than the racism and all that stuff, which is Black History Month. They're not taking a long-term view. And the short-term view of the profit outside is going to cripple us and cripple the next generation, these young ones that are going forward. And it's great to be here and listening to this and to encourage these young children to think forward, and the parents also, I challenge all parents and grandparents to teach their children to have a long-term view versus a short-term view.
And to risk.
And to risk.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of people are afraid of risk. Right. There's different risk profiles. And most people are conservative in their risk profile, and they won't go there. But as you said at the beginning of the talk, go to that uncomfortable zone, and that's where you're
going to
reap the biggest rewards.
Sure. I mean, Dean Kamen, the person I showed who developed the Segway and the water purification and 440 other unbelievable inventions, his mantra at his company, which is in New Hampshire, says, fail fast, fail often. Right? More so, when you're failing, it means as long as you learn something from it, you'll be much better off. So absolutely, I appreciate your comment. Absolutely. Thank you. Yes?
You talk about a lack of people of color in science disciplines, but from my point of view, I would talk about health science disciplines. There are a lot of people of color. Why is it more people of color have the French more than health science rather than the other
person? Sure, great question. Now, we gotta temper a lot. There are a lot more people of color in health sciences than none, but there are not a lot of people. I mean, when you go to the doctors, right? When you go to the hospitals, you're not seeing a whole bunch of black physicians and a whole bunch of black nurses. You see some, but there are more, I agree with you, than in engineering. Now, why is that? It's one of those things where if you are academically gifted and of color, you don't mess around with trying to become a nuclear physicist or a basic chemist. You're going to medical school, law school, engineering, or getting an accounting degree. You know what I mean? We don't have that. Our generation is starting to get a little different. But for the most part, you wanted to get that one degree or two degrees that was going to give you a cushy job. Whereas non-black population, if that kid grows up wanting to study physics, they're not thinking about, well, is that going to be a good job or not? They just want to study physics. We have a different set of controls. I mean, you notice, especially if you're a West Indian child, so I don't want you to be a doctor or a lawyer. You know, I mean, that's, you know, no, I like the piano. What? You know, you want to write, huh? Like, you're not interested in that. You know, doctor, lawyer, engineer. And so, you know, it's just one of those things where now, in the 21st century, we're a little more comfortable seeing doctors. It's interesting. I mean, when you look at ER or Grey's Anatomy, these shows, you're seeing a lot of black doctors there, or House. Yeah, not a lot, but you're seeing black doctors there and black nurses. It's almost like society's become comfortable with that. But when you look at other high-powered science shows, you don't see a black physicist or you don't see a black chemist. And so it's interesting. We just need to keep pushing. This is the short answer to that. We just need to keep pushing and try to distribute.
Because there's a black president, which I think has kind of opened the doors. If you notice, when Obama was rising before he took office, there was more exposure and more blacks present in the media and also in the shows. It loosened the views, I think, of the Americans when you put black people in non-traditionally seen black.
I'm going to follow up on that point because that's an excellent point. Having lived through the running and election of America's first black president, I don't care if you like Obama or don't like Obama. That is not my stick. That's up to you to decide. What I can tell you is the single fact that there was a black president in that country has changed the game, because every single black kid now can never say, doesn't matter, it's not like I can become president. No, you actually can. Now, I don't think all black kids are going to become presidents. We all know the reality. There's not a lot of Obamas. But the point is, the symbolism of that, and to your point about how press started saying, and it's really funny. I mean, if you follow this stuff, they've thrown everything at the dude. I mean, they tried everything. This guy is the squeakiest, and again, I don't care if you like him or not, but clearly he is squeaky clean. He's a family man. And he's working his butt off. And that is such an unbelievable example for black and brown kids. So that's another, thank you for raising that point as well. Sure.
About the school and education, one of the things she was mentioned is dropout. But in one generation, there was no talking about dropping off. So we were in the school, we were in the high school, university, for like getting master, getting my PhD. There was no thinking about dropping off. But I was working as a teacher and I was seeing the difference between that time and now. It is kind of like, right now I find it kind of like wasting time. For children, they have information. They have access to lots of information.
Exactly.
And it is kind of like, I look at the school as a place for babies. They give them discipline.
They babysit them from 8 to 4, and they don't know they have information in the internet. They have books, they have everything. Some of them, they know math, even in the age of 12, 13, you know. They know math in the level of university. They know science. So it is kind of
what we need. Well, I mean, that's another, you all are bringing up all the hot points.
That's absolutely an excellent point. Schools today suck. Let's call it what it is. Schools today, I'll speak in the U.S. Schools today, the K through 12 system is completely broken. It looks like this little building. You have desks in a row. You have a teacher that's trying to lecture to a kid. Teacher barely understands the topic themselves. The kid is bored out of their mind, and yet they have a smartphone or a computer, and all these other digital distractions coming at them left, right, and center. Why is a kid going to stay in school? You're absolutely correct, which is why we talk about changing the DNA. And here we talk about changing the DNA of science education, but it's really changing the DNA of all education. School has to look different. So Philadelphia has one of the largest dropout rates in the United States of America. Greater than 50% of the students in Philadelphia public schools drop out in grade 10. You walk around these high schools, the high school can accommodate 2,000 students, you'll see 300, 400, and I'm not exaggerating. It's horrible. We opened up a school in 2006, which I oversee, and it's a STEM school, it's a science-based school. We have 125 students per class. We've had no dropouts, and we started in 06, and we have two graduating classes so far. Why? We change what school looks like. If you go to our school, you're going to see desks spread out random ways. It's a one-to-one laptop. You're going to see the students engaging with other teachers, with other students, sorry, working through the laptop. So we're not saying that, oh, put your cell phones away or put your laptop away. No, let's embrace technology and figure out how to use that to stimulate these kids to keep them excited. So that's an amazing point. And I'm not saying that our school is the answer. I'm just saying we've had success with our school. But it's because we took school, we turned it on its head, and we made it as engaging and as exciting as we could for these 14 to 18-year-old kids. So absolutely. And more schools have to, whether it's our model or another model, more schools have to think like that. Otherwise, kids are just going to keep dropping out. It's boring. That system does not work anymore for our kids today. Well, if there are no other questions, sorry. See, you saw me try to sneak out, right?
Yeah, I'm just curious if you've seen model schools, programs that have shifted the balance a bit in terms of gender and so on, that has worked and has been replicated in some other regions of states. Is there any sort of...
Sure. So there's our school. Funny you asked that question. There's our school called Science Leadership Academy, started in 06. There are a bunch of schools. I mean, one thing about the U.S., everybody has an idea, boom, they try to do it. So there are a lot of schools that have done remarkable things. High Tech High, for example, in California, has a whole system that they've really changed science education, and people are trying to model that. I just got back from Egypt, actually, 3 weeks ago, because the Egyptian government came to the United States, studied a bunch of schools, and picked our school as the model. So we're actually creating our school, which we did in Philadelphia, outside Cairo. Now, what sucks about that is the Philadelphia school system is so screwed up, part of my term, is so messed up, that in Philadelphia, we're not replicating our school yet. So here is this foreign country that's interested in replicating it, but things are so gummed up and political in the state of Pennsylvania and the city of Philadelphia that while we want to replicate our school, because it's only helping 125 kids per grade, that's 500 students. There are 160,000 students in the school district of Philadelphia, of which about 80,000 are high school. So absolutely, there are some models that work. I'm happy to share with them if you want some more details later. But you know, we just need more. We need more of those models. So there was a question over here. All right.
Well, thanks again. Thank you. Just going to let the folks know they can watch this again on one of them digital devices or on their own screen. That's why McGill has paid for us to have this videotape. In about a week's time, they'll have it up and running. It'll be available on iTunes U. It'll be available through the Red Path Museum website. There'll be a link beside the Frederick Bertley talk thing. And it also goes to a local station. It's called Canal Savoir. It's a local cable. They show it about 4 or 5 times, spring, summer, next fall, and then again next winter. And I hope in a year from now to see you back here.
Absolutely.
Black History Month 2013.
You're right.